listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. Each week, my guest and I will bring you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Today, I have a guest by the name of Elizabeth Root. She'll be with us in just a bit, but first, I want to share a little bit of information with you about one of my favorite charities, and I urge you to check out the March of Dimes. March of Dimes is happening Capital Day 2010 on Tuesday, May 11th, and you can join volunteers from across California who will come together at the state capitol in Sacramento to advocate for our highest priority, the health of moms and babies. If you're interested in attending, please go to www.marchofdimes.com and enter the zip code of your community. You will find a link to all California events, or you can contact Nikita Smith at 858-576-1211. Now, this event is called March for Babies, and now through March 17, 2010, in 26 cities around California, more than a million supporters will come together to participate in March for Babies, America's favorite walking event. These wonderful walks support programs in your community that help moms have healthy, full-term pregnancies, and funds research into the problems that threaten babies. Locally, the Orange County, California Walk is Sunday, April 25th at Fashion Island. The LA County Walk is Saturday, April 24th at Exposition Park. But it doesn't stop here in California. There are hundreds of walks going on throughout the country. There are 35 in Florida, 34 in Georgia, 27 in Illinois. And the list goes on. There's 39 cities in Pennsylvania, 21 in Tennessee. There is at least one in every state. To find the date, time, and location of the event nearest you, go to www.marchfordimes.com and enter the zip code of your community. Do it. You'll have a lot of fun, be in an environment with great people, with great energy, and most of all, contribute to a great cause, healthy babies. Now, let me bring to you our guest. Our guest today is Elizabeth Root. And besides being a mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, Elizabeth is a licensed clinical social worker. She worked for 17 years as a psychotherapist and supporter of children and families in the public sector by helping them navigate their way through our community mental health system. Her concerns led her to write the book, Kids Caught in the Psychiatric Maelstrom, How Pathological Labels and Therapeutic Drugs Hurt Children and Families. Now, she devotes her time to continued advocacy for the change of the system through writing and speaking. Elizabeth, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you so much for having me, Alan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we are very glad to have you. I've had a chance to go through the book a little bit, and I've got a lot of questions, and I also want to share with you there are a lot of other questions coming in, and if you'll hold, or I guess you don't have to hold, but I have a question coming in live. Let me pull that up, okay?
Okay, all righty.
Let's see. Add to conference. Hi, you're on with Answers for the Family. Hello. Listener, you're on with Answers for the Family. Okay. I seem to have lost him. And please feel free to call back, and we will try to conference you in again. All right, Elizabeth, are you with us? Okay. I knew there was a reason why I shouldn't be doing it.
Hello?
Yes, are you with us?
I'm not on for you. I called the wrong number. I have to apologize.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. All right, Elizabeth, are you still with us?
I'm still here.
Okay. Now that's interesting. So we ended up getting a wrong number of sorts. Okay.
Well, I guess she was surprised.
Yeah. I'm sure when she was calling, I don't think she thought she was going to be put right on the air for a radio show. Well, anyway, as I was talking about in regards to the book, you mentioned in your book that we should look at societal trends for answers towards soothing the emotions of children whose symptoms are just natural expressions of distress. What do you suggest as a viable alternative to the way the psychiatric community deals with diagnoses such as ADD and pediatric bipolar disorder?
Well, I think that that they consider symptoms of a mental illness more as children who are unhappy and distressed over the way their lives are being managed these days. The immense changes in our society over the last 30 years, rate of technological change and the economic condition, the families, so that most parents have to work, with both parents, if there are two, need to work, leaving the children surrogate caregivers. So basically, they are regimented from the time they get up in the morning until they go to school, and then they go to a latchkey program or organized sports. They get home for dinner. It's a pretty hectic time. Everybody's tired. And really don't have access to the kinds of free play, running around outside in neighborhoods that those of us who were raised back in the 60s were. And the play, imaginative play, spontaneous play, then not organized by this very important optimal brain development in children. They got children to learn. So, treating children as though the problem resided within them in our society and of distress. It's not an easy, but I think different angle.
All right. Elizabeth, hang on just a minute. It seems like we're having some technical problems. So I think what I'd like to do, is just to take a break. Let me call you right back on another line, because apparently this line seems to be a little shaky because your signal's coming in. So everybody.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, everybody, please. We're going to take a break right now. We will be right back with Elizabeth Root.
Alan?
Yes.
Hello?
All right. We've got a much better connection.
Hello?
Yes. Can you hear me okay? Because I can hear you much better.
Oh, good. Yes, I can hear you okay.
Okay. Anyway, again, my apology on that. But let me go through that again, because I think that it was a little bit broken up, and you were talking a little bit in regards to more the situation of you know, I got bits and pieces of it, but...
Oh, okay. let me try to be a little more succinct. The trouble with the way the medical model, which is the dominant treatment method in the mental health system, the trouble with that model is that it makes a diagnosis of a child and then usually prescribes a drug to treat the illness that they decide the child has. Now, I think that that's going about our problem all wrong. There are many, many distressed children. That's true. But I don't believe it's an epidemic of mental illness. And, you know, the two most common ones being ADHD, attention deficit,
right,
hyperactivity disorder, and that bipolar.
Right.
I think that children are just distressed, and their behaviors are expressions of their unhappiness. with the state of affairs in their lives these days. You know, they don't have the opportunities to go outdoors at will and have spontaneous free play, imaginative play, going to the neighbors, you know, for their children in the neighborhood, having games of hide and seek. Instead, their lives are pretty much regimented because nowadays, in most families, both parents are working. Children have little time at home. Many of them are deprived of the early years at home with their primary caregivers. So many important developmental tasks are accomplished in the first months and years of life. It's all changed. Children are not having the opportunities to bond with their primary caregivers and to experience the kinds of play that are age-appropriate for the underage group, underage five group.
Okay.
And they're telling us how unhappy they are. And instead of understanding that these are natural expressions, we're labeling them with pathological labels and giving them drugs.
Okay.
To me, that's just all wrong.
Right. And I'm certainly in agreement with the fact that we have become an over-medicated society. But let's talk a little bit. In fact, let me go right into some of the listener questions because this may help a little bit. We've got one that says, you know, my niece was diagnosed as bipolar when she was 16. She is now 21. She's in college and living at home with her mother. This has been a roller coaster experience for everyone. She keeps going off of her meds because she says her brain is too fuzzy to focus on her classwork. Like clockwork, within a month of discontinuing her medication, she spirals into another bout of anxiety and depression. Her mother is at her wit's end. It says, if you feel that there are more natural ways of dealing with bipolar disorder, what might my sister and her daughter do?
I think that in the first place, all attempts should be made to avoid medication. Because once the medication is introduced into the brain, it does create a chemical imbalance. Psychotropic drugs actually disable the brain and create the illusion of better, improved behavior. But I think the niece's objections to the medicine tells it all. People do not like the effects that these medications have on them. They make them feel... They squelch their emotions. They feel flat or fuzzy, as she said. There are all kinds of bad side effects that people outside of the person don't understand. That's why so many people who have been prescribed the lithium, the other mood stabilizers that they prescribe for bipolar, they keep going off the medications because of the unpleasant side effects. But once they go off, the brain has been accommodating the infusion of the chemical, and when that's suddenly taken away, then the body and the cells of the brain react. It's a rebound reaction. It's not necessarily a reemergence of symptoms, but the medication has already upset the balance of the brain.
Okay.
So I think that first of all sorts of psychosocial remedies ought to be tried first and exhausted before they
Okay, well, let's get some examples, because I mean, I've got some thoughts in regards to this, but it sounds like, if you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like what you're saying is that by having been on the meds, and it looks like if she was 16, she's now 21, she's been on the meds for 5 years. If she discontinues taking them, what you're saying is that the brain has somewhat got conditioned to receiving these, and now by taking them off, that's what the anxiety and depression is being triggered by. It's that sort of a cold turkey situation. Now let's, living in the real world, that there are a lot of people on, you know, in this situation. I mean, if we wean them off, it would make sense to me that if we were to wean them off slowly, is that going to make a little more sense first to get them off? But the second point second point is, what do we then do if this person is still having trouble functioning without any of the drug?
Okay, that's two questions. Number one, absolutely, if the person decides that they do not want to take these drugs anymore, they should be under the care of a doctor who is in agreement, with allowing them to be weaned off, and the doctor should supervise that weaning. Right. And secondly, there are so many other ways of treating the mood swings. Now, I don't really know this person, so I can't,
sure,
can't be too specific. In the first place, many people are misdiagnosed. There are many more people that have this label, I think, than that actually have the severe mood swings that are typical of the bipolar. Many, many people have that label. It really isn't much of it. Now, there is a new movement afoot. It's about the plasticity of the brain. It's called neuroplasticity. And many scientists, psychiatrists, are recommending like mind-body treatments, like a yoga, meditation, mm-hmm, theater arts, art therapy, music, trance work, to help the brain, to help the neurons, to the reintegration of the neurons of the brain. Now our brain changes, over the course of a day with our changing moods. There are changes in the brain. It's a plastic organ,
mm-hmm,
and it has the ability to readjust itself, especially with the help, of one of these modalities, or even a relationship with a good therapist. A good therapeutic relationship can help restore that brain back to its optimal functioning.
Okay. Well, so it sounds like is that at the same time in which they're being weaned off under the care of a physician, that at the same time they should also be looking into some other things like a yoga type of therapy that's going to keep the brain functioning and sort of firing on all cylinders.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Yes. Sometimes people's what they eat can influence how they feel. So that's another aspect that could be looked at.
Well, and that's a great point, and actually that's one of the things that I had as one of my questions, especially as it relates to ADD or ADHD,
mm-hmm,
that, to what degree is diet, especially as we've added so much sugar into our diet, and especially as kids. I can remember eating cereal and loving that gooey, slushy part at the end that was just the raw sugar that had sunk to the bottom of the milk bowl. I thought that was the best part.
No.
Well, I know, but I know.
Yeah, they do add. You're right. They do add too much sugar.
Yeah.
But so. Go ahead.
With a lot of these kids that are being diagnosed, and again, when you were working within the system, a lot of these kids, that are being diagnosed with something like ADD or ADHD, how many of these, if we just alter their diet and reduce the huge amounts of sugar content that they're taking in, how many of those are we going to find all of a sudden aren't bouncing off the walls anymore?
A lot of them, I think. And it's not just sugar. Certainly, processed sugar is one of the biggest culprits. So there's absolutely too much of it being taken in children these days. But it's the food additives in the processed foods, the additives, the food dyes, the preservatives. These are petroleum-based. They're persistent pollutants of the brain. They do neurological harm. So those should be avoided. And
now you said
processed sugar should be totally avoided. It might be helpful for a family to get the assistance of a nutritionist to help identify which foods it might be that are causing these behaviors, and eliminating one at a time so that one can be identified. It may be a rather lengthy process to figure out exactly which foods need to be avoided, but it certainly is worth the effort.
Okay, and while we're talking about, like right now, the ADHD, another question that came in via email, and again, I want to thank those listeners that are sending these emails in. I want you to know that I take them very seriously, and I try to get as many of them as possible out to our guests. Now, here's another one that comes in where it says, it seems like every one of my friends with two or more children has at least one of their kids has been diagnosed with ADHD. It says, what are doctors using as criteria or symptoms to make this determination?
Oh, that's such a good question. What the doctor is doing is the same as what any one of us could do, is to observe the child's behavior, and also to find out from the, you know, to get information from the parents and other significant people in the child's family. But the criteria to make the diagnosis are simply watching the child's behavior, how active the child is, how able he or she is to focus, those symptoms that are commonly recognized by observers. You know, you can tell a child that has trouble sitting still. There is absolutely no medical test. There's nothing special that a doctor does that's different from the therapist or even, another intelligent observer of a child can just by watching the child. There is no test. There's no neurological electroencephalogram or anything like that that can tell you that a child has ADHD or ADD. It's simply a matter of watching the child's behavior.
Okay. Now,
it's very subjective.
Now, what about some of these other tests? I mean, the tests, and I obviously what you're saying is they're not being used in this scenario, but we are coming into an age in which there's more brain mapping done. Is this something that is going to be used more in the future, or is it not really on the horizon for kids that are in the mental health system, that you've worked in?
There are a lot of brain studies being done. Actually, that's somewhat of a matter of concern because many, many thousands of children are being exposed to these strong magnetic fields, the MRIs, and worse yet, the CAT scans and the SPECT. Those are exposing children to radiation that could be very dangerous, cancer-causing, in the future years to come. So it's really not a good thing that so many children's brains are being scanned at this point. Furthermore, the American Psychiatric Association recognizes the fact that this is not a diagnostic tool. It's simply a research tool at this point, is using all these brain scans to learn more about the functioning of the brain. But it does not diagnose bipolar, ADHD, ADD, schizophrenia, any so-called mental disorder cannot be diagnosed with a brain scan.
Okay, so then what are we to do? I mean, as parents, what are we to do when, and again, I mean, from my standpoint, we're doing adolescent transport. So we're doing crisis intervention and adolescent transport. We're working with the families in some cases. In other cases, we're just operating under an assignment from the school district that says that this child's unable to function within this system, and we're taking them to a specialized school. What are some of the alternatives, again, that the parent can use when their psychiatrist says, for instance, and we had a question that came in on Ritalin, so where they say, okay, this child should be on Ritalin. What are some of the other options?
Some of the other options are accommodating the child's learning style. A child that has trouble sitting still, it's a natural attribute of that child. If we look at the evolutionary history of man, those behaviors that boys typically exhibit of high activity, alertness, quick reflexes, quick movements, and speed, those are the behaviors that help preserve the species over eons. And now, in a very short span, speaking evolutionarily, suddenly we're saying that these behaviors, these characteristics, are pathological, and we're forcing children to change their behavior to accommodate to a new culture.
Okay.
So so it's, you know, to say that this is a pathology, it's, there are even some psychiatrists who are saying this is an evolutionary, this is the way boys develop,
right,
evolutionarily. So it's not a pathology. It's not an illness. And, you know, there is a time when it really served a purpose. And it's not natural for children to have to sit still and do seat work all day long.
Right.
So what schools need to do is provide more opportunities for exercise, more hands-on kinds of activities. And there's a scientist, educational psychologist named Jane Healy, who wrote some books about how children's brains have changed since the 90s, since all of this, so much screen work, children have been exposed to so much with computers and television that it's actually changed the structure of their brain so that they're not the kinds of learning that they're presented with, the kinds of education they have in school, is no longer compatible with the way their brains are working. So they actually need more of a faster-paced curriculum,
mm-hmm,
that can help them keep moving. And she's not even saying that this is all bad. She's just saying that the children's learning styles have changed, and many of them are having a lot of trouble living with the system that they're presented with in the schools.
Well, and at this point, it doesn't look like we're headed in the right direction, because based on our economy and the cutbacks that I've seen in the schools, I think we're going in just the opposite. I mean, when I'm seeing the things that they're cutting out, they're cutting out more sports-related things, and they're cutting out more,
mm-hmm,
artistic-related things. The two things,
right,
the two things that what you're saying is that we need most seems to be what they're cutting out. And actually, I was starting to smile as I was looking at the board, and while you were talking about boys saying it's just kind of a natural thing for them to not be able to sit still and kind of flit around here and there and stuff, and I looked at the board thinking, I'm expecting my mom to call at any minute and go, but that's the way he's been all of his life. They go, you just described him, and nobody medicated me, you know. So
yes, that's right.
Well,
that's another thing that our American schools seem to be doing everything backwards. Now, if you look at, Finland is number one academically in the world in language, and is not far behind in math. And they don't start children to school until they're 7 years old. Up until that time, they're allowed to do age-appropriate activities. And then once they do start school, up through the early grades, they're allowed to have 15 minutes of recess following every 45-minute academic period.
Well, now, if they're number one in the world, then why are we not looking towards that, and seeing that as a possible model for our kids?
Well, now, isn't that the question? Yes. That's the very question that I pose in my book. We should be looking towards, in other words, instead we're doing the opposite. We're starting children earlier and earlier in preschools, expecting them to start learning how to do academic work when they're, way before it's natural for them to do so.
Right. And they just announced here in California, and I believe it was geared towards, I think it was Los Angeles County, that they're going to cut back even more as far as the amount of time that they're in school, but also the amount of time that they can have doing any form of sports or any form of art. And really, if you think about it, if they really felt that they needed to cut back, why don't they look towards kind of what you're saying here is, A, we can start a little bit later, and B, if we're going to have more sports-related or more play-related things, maybe they could, if they would put that in, maybe there's a way that it would not cost as much, if we're doing that rather than the specific structured things that has them in a chair.
Excellent, yes.
So
there's a lot of creative thinking to be done in this area. Certainly.
There sure is. You know what? We're going to take a break, when we come back, we're going to have some more questions, and one of the questions has to do with specifically with Ritalin. So again, we're speaking with Elizabeth Root, and we will be back in 1 minute. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, WestShield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, WestShield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
To Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
All right, we're back with Elizabeth Root, and we are talking about our kids and the amount of drugs that they're being prescribed. So with that, one of the questions that was emailed in comes in. And I'm trying to think of from where. Anyway, but it says, which pharmaceutical company makes Ritalin, and how did they seem to get such a strong influence with doctors who are treating kids with this drug? And then it has a second question. It says also, what are the side effects of Ritalin? So those two questions come in from one person via email.
Okay.
What?
I'm pretty sure that Novartis makes Ritalin. I'm not, you know, I think that's right. That doesn't, you know, the question is, how do they have such a strong influence on the psychiatrists that,
right,
that are prescribing? Well, there's a long story that goes with the alliance that exists between psychiatry and the pharmaceutical companies.
Okay, can you give us a Cliff Notes version, and for the people that want to know more, they can get the book.
They can read all about the history of how this happened in my book, that's for sure. In the chapter about the drugs. But anyway, it started back in the 80s, and over since that time, there has been what's been given the title of a psychopharmaceutical complex, which is the alliance between the psychiatrists. Many academic psychiatrists are allied with drug companies for the purpose of making a lot of money. They've learned how they can line their pockets by turning to this alliance with drug companies. And actually, the Senate Finance Committee has been investigating some of these alliances, and some revelations have emerged regarding some pretty shady practices of doctors withholding how much millions of dollars they're making on this. So that's a matter of investigation. Now, the second question was about the side effects.
Yes.
Ritalin, the psychostimulant, the generic name for the Ritalin family is the methylphenidate.
Okay.
And this research shows that, well, for one thing, those drugs do stunt growth if the child is on them for a number of years, in the developing years. Children that have been on it for years, say around the age of 14, are 3 centimeters shorter than children that have that same label but weren't on the drugs.
Mm.
And this is one aspect of that. During that growth spurt period between, you know, the pre-adolescent age, there's such important brain development going on. And if the facial cranial bones are not growing the way they should, this could have neurological effects on the, you know, certain kinds of subtle brain damage could occur.
Right. Well, it sounds like what you're saying is that if there's documentation that it's stunting the physical growth, as far as height, which I think what you're saying is that...
And weight. Uh-huh. Well, and weight
and,
as well.
Yeah, height and weight. Then it can very well be also stunting the mental growth of the brain.
That's right.
Is that
yes.
okay?
Simply put, yes, that's
okay.
true. Also, there are psychiatric symptoms, side effects of the drugs. Some children become manic. They act manic when they're on the stimulant drugs because, after all, they are stimulants. In fact, they're very closely related to cocaine. The effect on the brain is almost identical to cocaine. These psychostimulants are Schedule II controlled substances. So they can make a child more active and act manic and even have hallucinations. And unfortunately, a lot of times when this happens, the doctor will up the diagnosis to bipolar instead of recognizing these as side effects of the stimulant. Also, there are cardiovascular effects that are associated with the stimulant medications. For instance, Adderall was banned in Canada because some children actually died of cardiac arrest, and a few children also had stroke. And so the Adderall, which was it was banned in Canada, but that's still used pretty widely in the United States.
Now, is Adderall the one that was also, there was some ties to memory loss as well?
Inhibition of the brain development? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, no,
I
just recall at one point there was one particular drug, and I thought that was the one to where they were tying it to some memory loss. Maybe that's not the one.
Well, I don't know. Could be. It could be. I haven't heard that.
Okay, so let me...
The other thing is that the stunted growth, they used to think that the child would catch up once they were off the drug, but that's not the case. These children that were studied, once they were off the drug, they did not catch up. They remained behind, you know, the other group of ADHD children that didn't take the drugs.
All right. Now, I reading in the book, there was something that I saw in there that it says that there were some of the drugs, some of the mood stabilizing drugs, some of the side effects. One of the ones that caught my was that causing breast enlargement in boys.
Oh yes. Now we're talking about the antipsychotics.
Right.
The most common of which are the Risperdal. Zyprexa, Seroquel, Geodon, these are in order of probably prevalence of use in children. And yes, in fact, in my own caseload, I noticed a breast enlargement in a number of the boys that were on the drug, and I was sometimes the first person to raise this as an issue. And eventually, the doctor would have to take the boy off the drug, and sometimes this is an irreversible condition, which there are some cases where boys have had to have mastectomies.
Now, other than your own personal studies, are there some other studies now that have been, I guess, placed in the medical journals or whatever that to a point?
Oh, this isn't just my no. I just happened to observe this in a couple of the boys, a few of the boys, not just a couple. But no, it's a well-known fact. It's in other books about how the endocrine system is upset by these antipsychotic drugs. They can also cause girls to lactate, have milk actually produced in their breasts at the age of 12, for instance. This happened to one of the girls I had. But I'm not basing it on that anecdotal case. I'm basing it on what I in my research. I read about the endocrine problems that are caused by these drugs.
Meaning that the information...
That could even lead to infertility, in adulthood.
Wow.
And more common perhaps is the weight gain, which is almost universal. Most children or youth that are put on these drugs have a dramatic weight gain and therefore are at risk of type 2 diabetes.
Okay, which then puts them in another situation to where they they now have to take insulin, right?
Well, no, not necessarily. Type 2 diabetes is not always treated with insulin, sometimes with medication, sometimes with insulin, but it does put them at risk of further problems, you know, cardiovascular, all the problems that go along with being overweight.
Well,
so this is a very serious situation.
Well, right now, our country financially is in a crisis. Our government, most every state and our federal government is hugely in debt. And so I think some of the laws are going to start changing based on financial decisions. So in other words, I think that's one of the reasons why marijuana is going to be legalized. I think that there are things I've written on in regards to running away, where running away was deemed legal or illegal based on the need for teenagers in our workforce when you look back in our history. So now looking at something like this and saying, okay, government is going to make their decisions a little differently right now, what are some of the things that we can do and present it to government in such a way that they can look at it and say, this is going to save them money. This is going to save them money in within the schools. It's going to save them money by spending less in having to have more people in prison later on. I mean, so many different things. If there's things that we can do and we can start them early, and that's been my thing. If we can start them early in such a way, I know in some of the schools now they're trying to change the diet within the school. They're taking a lot of the stuff out because they're now getting it. They're realizing that, well, wait a minute. We're providing the kids with the school lunches with all of these processed foods, with a bunch of sugary foods, and then saying, well, wait a minute. Now the kids are all hyped up and out of control. Well, look what you're giving them. So what can we do from the bigger picture standpoint that the government will get behind? Because right now, that's who we need to get behind.
I think your suggestion is a great one, starting with school lunches. In fact, where I live in Trumansburg, the elementary school has a project, which I'm going to learn more about it on Friday, going to a presentation. But they have kids raising their own food in gardens at the elementary school. Then they cook the foods. They teach the children how to cook the foods. So they're out in the garden, working in the garden, in the soil, and then they're cooking. They have all these hands-on projects, which are not only improving their diet, but they're also presenting them with all these learning activities, which are exactly the kind of activities I was talking about earlier that kids need more of right now.
Right.
So if all the schools were doing this kind of thing, I think we would see a big difference in the number of children that end up in trouble.
And this is in public school?
Yes.
Yeah, see, that's...
Yep,
That just makes great sense from the standpoint of teaching. You know, you're teaching them something very positive, and at the same time, you're feeding them the things that they should be taking in. So I think we're building better eating habits. I know right now, Michelle Obama is saying that the biggest crisis we have is obesity in this country. Guess what? This would go after that too. So, let's get somebody like her behind it and say, look, let's do this. This is going to help in so many different ways, but we've got to get somebody, in a powerful enough position to make this happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish we could also get President Obama to read my book, because typically people in high positions like him, even like the Surgeon Generals, are so, they're so overly exposed to the medical model and thinking in terms of mental illness, all this loaded with stigma. And if we could only turn it around and stop looking at children as being, sick, take the problem away from the child and put the problem where it belongs in certain aspects of our society that really need to be changed. We need to attack poverty. We need to treat children that are troubled in ways that help an entire family instead of putting a child on a drug, or worse yet, putting the child in an institution. The whole family needs to be looked at. They call it a wraparound program.
Right.
Where the child is left in the home, but the whole family receives the kinds of programs that are going to help, you know, like better housing, job training, things that are going to lift people out of poverty.
Right.
And things that are going to treat people with respect. You know, the lower income people are so targeted, especially with these screening programs where they want to screen all the children for mental illness. And they're starting with the low-income families, as if somehow low-income parents are inferior or some such, which it just is not true. I mean, you know how hard it is when you're economically depressed, you don't have money, you don't have a job. It's really hard to be cheerful and to do the things that are characteristic of good parenting. But it's not the people, it's their circumstances.
Right. Now,
so that's what we need to attack.
Now, with the screening you're talking about, I think you're referring to the New Freedom Commission on Mental Health. I think that because I know that in your book, you refer to that as well. So tell us exactly,
yes.
Tell us briefly, because we've only got about 5 minutes, mm-hmm. Tell us what that is, and if this is something that is that maybe parents need to look into more, tell us how to mm-hmm. do that.
Yes, well, it's mushroomed. It started with the idea of screening all children in the schools for mental illness. But it's moved right on down into the cradle now, where they're sending workers. And since 2005, there's a 5-year grant to do this, ending this year, where workers are going in and doing quick questionnaires to figure out whether 3-month-old children are potentially going to have mental illness or psychosis. How you can do this with a 3-month-old baby is mind-boggling. But anyway, that's what's happening. This is the kind of screening we're talking about. Very short questionnaires. And the United States Preventive Services Task Force has already said that these instruments, these 10-minute questionnaires, are unreliable. And in the case of suicidality in youth, it has not prevented suicides. So these instruments are not reliable, and they're really useless. And then, and what's happening is that many people are being given labels that they don't deserve. So it's just perpetuating this whole pathological picture of looking at children as being, pathologizing the children, instead of making the societal changes that we really need to do.
Well, now who is backing this? In other words, you said that it's a 5-year grant. So who is pushing this through?
Well, it's the New Freedom Commission on Mental Health.
But who are they? Is what I'm saying.
Well, this was a group of doctors and psychologists and various different kinds of mental health professionals that President George W. Bush commissioned to do this work, to develop this report.
Okay.
And this is what they came up with. They came up with 6 objectives, and the main one was this middle one, this number 4, which was sort of a Trojan horse among the other 6. The other 5 were, you know, pretty innocuous kinds of objectives.
Okay.
So this is how the screening started,
okay.
And it's mostly funded by the government.
All right.
Government programs.
Okay, Elizabeth, let me get, I've got another listener question. I want to make sure and get that in, and we're down to about 2 minutes. This one says, it says, my ex-husband was bipolar, as was his father and sister, but he refused to go to the doctor or admit he had a problem. It became impossible to deal with his severe mood swings, and eventually our marriage ended in divorce. For people who have bipolar family members, how do they help their loved ones and stay sane themselves? And we've got about 1 minute.
Well, again, there's no evidence. There's no scientific evidence that these so-called diseases are inherited. They can be learned from their family members. I don't know how a family. You know, it takes a lot of patience and understanding and trying out different remedies before using the drugs, because. As the previous example showed, the drugs often don't work as a lasting solution. So, I mean, the other methods that we talked about, the medication, the mind-body connection, so many other things can be tried, diet changes, before resorting to medication. And, of course, it's going to take a lot of forbearance and patience on the part of the partner or the spouse.
All right.
It's not an enviable position to be in, I admit that.
Okay, let me wrap this up because we're just about out of time, but I also want to get in. If somebody wants to get the book, how can they get that?
Well, they could go with the Amazon.
Okay.
Amazon, the bookstores, they can order it through bookstores. They can go to a website called mindfreedom.org. That's all one word, mindfreedom.org, and part of the money will go to that organization, which is a great organization that's helping people that don't want to be part of the system, you know, what are struggling with their own personal issues.
All right.
So mindfreedom.org or Amazon or ABC Clio to the publisher, ABC Clio, ABC, that's just ABC CLIO. Or Prager. Those are harder things to remember, so I think that Amazon's the easiest, probably the easiest.
Right. Okay. Elizabeth, thank you so much. I appreciate it. We're out of time, but again, anybody, it is called Kids Caught in the Psychiatric Maelstrom. You can get that through Amazon, or if you didn't catch this or if you're driving, just go to our website, www.answers4thefamily.com, and we will forward you the information you need.
And my website is betsyroot.com.
Okay.
They can read more at my website, betsyroot.com.
Betsyroot.com.
Betsyroot.
.com. Thank you so much. Uh-huh. Have a great week.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bye now.
Bye now.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.